Hey guys, it's the Nerdist Podcast number 288. This is a very exciting episode, which I will get to in a minute. But first, I want to say that if you're in Nashville or Chicago, I'm going to be performing at Zany's in both cities. December 6th through 9th in Nashville, and the following weekend in Chicago, and then Rosemont. So Zany's, go to their website, get tickets, or you can go to Nerdist.com/calendar for ticket links there. I would also like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. It is the holidays. Why? You're going to have to mail a lot of things, and you really don't want to be going into or near the post office at this time of year. Listen, the last few times I went to the post office, I really felt like they didn't want me there. So it's a win for everyone to use Stamps.com. You can print out exactly the postage you need from your computer with your Stamps.com account, and they'll just come pick it up from your house. You don't have to leave your house. You could just do all your shopping online. We're basically going to be you know, the alien, the sort of the Roswell alien that everyone goes, that's an alien from another planet. Those are future humans, actually. I think that was just a time machine experiment that we're just going to live these isolated existences in our homes, and we're going to lose all our hair because we're not going to need it to go outside, and then our eyes are going to get really big because we're staring at a computer all the time. And I have to tell you something, I'm fine with that. If we all just sort of look like generic vanilla bald beings, No prob. So mail anything you want from your computer using stamps.com to become the bald vanilla being that you've always wanted to become, and enjoy the holidays without having to get yelled at the post office. So if you go to stamps.com right now, click on the radio microphone at the top of the screen, enter the promo code Nerdist to get a bunch of cool bonus offers. At stamps.com, promo code Nerdist. Now this episode is Mel Brooks. Again, this has been such an amazing year for, I mean, I've enjoyed doing the podcast the entire time, but really, I had made a list of, like, here's a bunch of people that I really, really, really hope to get on the podcast someday, and we are ticking them off. There's still a lot to go, but Mel Brooks was a huge one. Mel is just like your granddad or your uncle. He's such a great guy. We talked to him for like an hour and 40 minutes, and he was lovely and got so much information about some of my favorite movies of all time that I didn't know before from Mel himself, that I really enjoyed talking to him. And I hope you, if you're at all any kind of a comedy fan, then I think you will enjoy this episode of the Nerdist Podcast with Mr. Mel Brooks. Oh, by the way, I have to tell you the best thing that happened after we finished recording the podcast. Jonah had years ago had found, by the way, huge, like, so freaked out that we got to sit down with Mel Brooks. And years ago, Jonah, when he worked at a record store, got this High Anxiety soundtrack album, like an original album. And so he was really shy. And so after the podcast, I was like, hey, Mel, do you mind signing Jonah's High Anxiety album? And he was like, no, of course not. I'd love to. And so he had picked up on the Matt Jonah dynamic. And so he actually signed Jonah's record to Matt and then crossed it out to Jonah. It was such a gorgeous moment. Such a gorgeous moment. And Jonah, like, I thought he was going to burst into tears with joy. He thought it was so funny. So just a little behind the scenes moment. Just to let you know how awesome Mel Brooks is. But you'll listen. Here we go again. Nerdist Podcast, Mel Brooks.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Katie, she's Levine? Our producer.
Yes. You're Levine, right?
Yes.
This is Levine, that's Jonah Ray, and that's Matt Myra over
Hello.
There.
You are?
I'm Jonah Ray.
Jonah Ray?
Yeah. How you doing, Matt?
Nice to meet you. And you're Matt. And you, how long is this group together? How long have you worked together?
Well, on this show, we started this show about 2.5 years ago. I knew Jonah when we used to do open mic comedy together, like in the year 2000. And Matt and I, we became friends maybe like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then we just started a podcast just as a way to sort of hang out.
Who started the podcast?
I guess I did. Yeah. I thought of it.
And don't you need money?
That is the big question for the internet. The internet should just be called Don't You Need Money.
Chris has been promising us money for a long time now, and I just hope it's on its way.
You guys, you're getting college credit.
I don't understand how you get any money. Who gives you money? How do you get money?
I can explain it.
Just say, oh, thanks. I enjoyed it so much.
I can explain it. It's
sometimes admiration is enough.
It's a new currency.
Yeah, I tried to tell...
Tell that to the landlord.
I tried to tell my landlords.
Really,
I'm like,
by the way, you're running the building.
Listen, a lot of people like me, kind of.
No, you know, it sort of works like a radio show in that we have, you know, a certain number of listeners, and so sponsors come on because they know...
Sponsors,
yeah. The shows are sponsored
like
now.
Like who would be a sponsor?
Amazon.com.
Amazon, Samsung.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Stamps.com. Movies come on as sponsors sometimes. Television shows.
Who do they pay the money to?
My company.
To your company?
Mm-hmm.
And who do you pay the money to have the space, the time? I mean...
Well, it doesn't really cost that much to make the podcast. I mean, I pay these guys. Katie gets paid, but the podcast is a part of a larger media company. We also make television shows, and you know, we have like web video channels and that live shows and that kind of thing. So it's a part of a bigger thing.
Well, what's the bigger thing named?
Nerdist Industries.
Oh, so it's Nerdist Industries.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It is. I mean, it must. Is this kind of stuff interesting to you to figure out
the
new media?
Yeah, I've always wanted to know who paid for what and how you get things done. You know, I make movies. I used to make movies before I went to Broadway. You know,
I remember.
Yeah,
we're all.
If I did right now, even as I speak to you, if I said, "Okay, I'm working on History of the World Part 2.
Finally!
Yeah. Here's some space. I'm looking forward to it.
Hitler on Ice.
Yeah.
Hitler on Ice. And I did, actually did, all the things I promised. You know, and I had Jews in Space and Hitler on Ice, you know. And then maybe some other, you know, I haven't done Civil War or anything, you know. I mean, there are other sections of history I haven't covered, you know.
Yeah.
I think I could... make, you know, opening weekend would be $60 million.
I think you could do that. Have you ever thought, like, what was the, why did History of the World Part 2, like, what happened? Was it a financing thing, or you got caught up?
No, it was a
stuff?
Joke. I never intended to do it. Yeah. It was always
a joke. I'm an idiot.
Well, the fact that the movie was called History of the World Part 1, to set up that it was going to be an anthology.
But I just like all those years, I totally bought into it. I was like, when's a sequel coming?
But they never...
Right. You know, but kids don't understand satire or irony or...
I understood it better than most kids because I was a comedy nerd, so the tapestry of my life was all comedy albums, every comedy special in the 70s and 80s, your movies, like everything. I mean, I was way in on board. But still,
none of the kids understood. I got letters to this day. From people who are 63 years old, you know.
So wait, so there's not going to be a sequel? I don't get it.
Where's part two? When are you going to do part two?
It's like if they put out The Godfather, and when they put it out in theaters for the first time, it was called The Godfather Part 1. It's like doing that, you know.
No, I understand now, Joan. I understand. I was an idiot for 20-some years. I get it. I totally get it now.
Yeah. Nobody ever did part one knowing.
No, yeah.
That's why I did it.
That must be so frustrating. And then people are like, when's the sequel? And you're like, it was a goddamn joke, please.
Yeah, it was. But I'm thinking now, there's a lot of money in that joke. If I put it together, you know.
You could do it, too.
I could do it. Jonah and?
Matt,
okay.
A friend of mine, I think maybe this was when you were working on maybe a Spaceballs animated project, but he said it was a long time ago. My friend Rob Paulson said you guys were all in a group and they were pitching jokes to you. And you were trying to come up with a name for one of the dinks in this thing that you're making. And he said, how about Gunga Dink, because he brings someone water.
Yeah.
And Rob thought this was the greatest joke he had ever written, and he thought he was going to get so much props from you, and then you go, kid, wit is shit, funny is money. do you believe that?
I believe I said that. I don't believe it's true, but, you know, it sounds good.
It sounds good.
It sounds good.
Well, you... they sent us this DVD box set with bonus CD, The Incredible Mel Brooks, an irresistible collection of unhinged comedy, which is, it's pretty unbelievable.
Did anybody over there look at it?
Absolutely. Because it's not just like, oh, here's a couple of Mel Brooks movies. It's literally like insane appearances with you and Dick Cavett, and then The Critic, which was the short film that you won the Academy Award for. And just, it's an incredible collection. All Carson appearances.
Yeah.
So how do you...
there's even one of me with... the guy who used to do commercials for Milton Berle.
What?
Sid Stone, who used to do the Fire Chief commercials. He was a pitch man. And he'd unfold his little stand, and he'd sell things like, I don't know. And in the end, he was selling Texaco gasoline.
Yeah.
You know, and he always did different things, and he always needed different stooges. I don't know how he got me. I was like 22 or something, just begun writing the show of shows. So he must have heard of me through some other comedy outlets. Maybe I was doing shots at the Village Vanguard as a stand-up and, you know, trying to get arrested. And so I became a, you'll see it. I'm 22, I'm a window washer.
Yeah.
And I'm doing things like, the only thing that really bothers me is pigeons, otherwise I'm fine. And I do this kind of dopey little window washer. And I completely forgot about it. I mean, it's like 70, 60 years, something. I mean, I had no memory at all. You know, it's like Lost Horizon or something. And yes, and I was, do you mean I was actually a member of parliament from, you know, I was that kind of, you know, I had no memory of having done this commercial.
So what was your reaction when you saw it?
So they found it, and I went to the Paley, there's the Paley Center.
Yeah, the Paley Center,
And I said, oh my God, that's me, you know. And then we, when we were putting this together, I thought, well, maybe this is a, you know, this is like a rarity and an antiquity, you know. So we got some rights to it, and we threw it in. You know?
I mean, this is like the rights that you got for all this, to all the, like, even getting the Tonight Show and throwing Get Smart on here, and then like the Get Smart pilots on here.
Yeah, the Get Smart pilot is good. It's wonderful. Mr. Big was Michael Dunn, this dwarf, and but what's great about the Get Smart part of this is that Buck Henry and I he came to Carl's house, and we kind of, you know, we filmed it, we taped it, and we got into the same arguments. I did the shoe telephone. I did the cone of silence. No, I did. And we finally decided that Buck Henry, actually, we wrote it together, he actually did create the cone of silence.
Okay.
And I did create the shoe telephone. Now, there's no residuals in the cone of silence, doesn't mean.
Sure.
And it doesn't work.
But it's a comic currency, like, yeah, who gets credit, yeah, for, yeah, which, right, joke?
But I should get credit for the cell phone.
You do actually get credit. I think
I started the cell phone with Agent, you know, 86's shoe telephone, you know.
So I was surprised that when the cell phone revolution began, that there was, that someone didn't make like a joke shoe cell phone.
I think they did, and I think it didn't sell.
It didn't do as well.
I think they tried it.
No, I remember you could get them in like the Sharper Image catalog. Yeah. There were shoe phones.
Yeah, there were.
Yeah.
I think I made about $80.
Yeah. Is that weird that I, oh, there was a cricket. Is that,
there still is a cricket, yeah.
Now, do you keep the crickets in here to keep the comedy fresh and real, so it always reminds you? What
no, it's nice. It's a brushstroke of nature. In a hard technical world, you know, it's nice to have, you know, living things, creatures that care about life and death.
That sing to you,
yeah,
while you're trying to write comedy. I just recently became pals
that
with you.
There's really not a cricket here. That's me.
Oh, my God. Are you okay?
It's really me.
You're being your own worst critic. Right. He's being your own cricket. Right.
He's being his own worst critic.
Thank you. I just recently became friends with your son Max, who I love. You brought this thing that Zombie Survival Guide is number 9 on bestsellers.
How did it get the? You know, I mean, isn't this crazy? When did it come out? Like 5, 6, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Actually, my guess is 2003.
2003?
Yeah. So it's been around.
Yeah. He's a good guy, and we're exactly the same age, and all of our references are exactly the same. But we were talking about movies. We had lunch a couple weeks ago. We were talking about movies and just movies we liked when we were growing up. And I go, oh, I really loved – we talked about Show of Shows. I loved My Favorite Year. And he goes, that was about my dad.
Yeah.
That was about my dad having to babysit Errol Flynn.
That's true.
When he came, and I don't know how I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So what was that – what was the story?
Well, he had redheaded twins, Cuban twins, who had dyed beautiful red hair, and he kept them in the Waldorf Towers. and he was booked to do the show of shows, and it wasn't Harrelson, it was somebody else.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know, it was, but it was an English actor.
Okay.
And then he was, he cut a swath, a wide swath through a lot of, you know, glamorous ladies. And, you know, and anyway, I had to make sure that he knew the sketches and he knew what he was saying and he knew what he was doing and he could memorize a few things. And so what happened? It could go either way. It's a teeter-totter. It's a seesaw. Either you can straighten out Errol Flynn and get him right and get him up and get him knowing, or he can send you up into the Cuban clouds.
Right. You know?
So, I mean, and quite often I was just, you know, just full of rum and dancing with the Cuban girls, and I didn't teach him a thing, you know. But every once in a while I knew my job, and I would you know, get him to study and tell him what the sketch was all about.
Yeah.
You know?
What did television feel like in those days? Would it, where I mean, like, the Show of Shows is a pretty innovative show at the time. Do you think it's felt in those days what the internet revolution feels like now? I mean, it's a fairly new medium when you're writing.
You know,
on that,
Chris,
show.
This is an incredible moment of education for you and for everybody listening.
Yes.
We're always stepping back and looking at something and saying, how different, how quaint, how remarkable, how dull, how stupid, how whatever. You know, looking at a piece of quote art. You know. But when you're in it, it is. Yes, it just simply is. You say, how was it? It was like now. I was living it.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that that you could ever be outside it and watch it.
Yeah.
Because you were living it. You were it. It is. Yes, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we are talking to each other. And Matt and
Jonah,
Matt and Jonah and Chris and
Katie,
and we're here. We're in my office. I'm paying rent here
with admiration.
Yes, and you know, and if I live another 5 years or 10 years, and it's possible because there's a guy called Norman Lloyd who is 98.
Mm-hmm.
He still plays tennis. Norman Lloyd is the guy hanging from the Statue of Liberty in Alfred Hitchcock's Sabotage.
Oh,
he's the bad guy whose jacket rips, the seam rips stitch by stitch, until finally all Robert Cummings is left with is his sleeve. And he screams, and there's a remarkable shot at looking down from the head of the Statue of Liberty when Norman Lloyd perishes.
Oh, wow.
And he's alive. He's 98.
So he survived that fall. So what if I didn't understand that was a movie?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is he may be the only one living who could step back and say, let me tell you how it was.
Right.
You know?
Well, I just think, you know, even though that at the time that was your present, that was your reality, and you didn't think of it in those terms.
Exactly. You can't get outside what is.
But you're still doing at that time a revolutionary thing, and you're on the biggest show at the time, and Sid Caesar, I mean, just hearing these stories about how...
No, I think like you do sometimes. For instance, Shelby,
yes.
That letter that I got from Shamey Me,
yes.
I put on your desk. Can you bring it to me, please?
Sure, it's an invitation.
Yeah, it's an invitation. It's a weird invitation. It's a restaurant that's being blessed by a Monsignor, right? Yeah, shaming me. No, can I have the envelope? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the envelope. So, talking to you,
sure,
about what you're basically talking about is that I was thrilled when I saw it because the stamp was so different. So it caught my eye, and I kept looking at it, and I just about made out in little red letters in the charcoal bottom of it, Edith Piaf. That's who that person is.
Oh, wow.
So I was thrilled. I was thrilled to see her. But Edith Piaf, when she was struggling for a few pennies, sous, they were called in French, you know, in the backyards of the Parisian tenements and singing in the, you know, she had no idea that one day people would say, oh, my God, Edith Piaf, you know?
Yeah.
She was just...
And that this moment of her would just be a snapshot in time.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, we all I do it too. I have the same stupid feelings you do about the past and how wonderful things were, and they gain a certain amount of stature and glory simply because they were in the past. Mm-hmm. But I think when they were doing them, it was a struggle to get a laugh, to make a living, to, you know.
Yeah.
And now, but now we look back at them like they're truly hunks of art.
Well, it's funny, you know? When you're a young comic and you're I think when you first start out doing comedy and then you kind of go, all right, all the stuff that's happening now is really innovative and the old stuff, we're better than that stuff now. We're different. And then the older you get, you realize, nope, it's all the same. The comedy writers have always been the same. Right. There's the same right. kind of mindset. The jokes, a lot of the jokes still hold up. It's the same yeah. exact thing.
You can track them all back.
Yeah.
But what were you guys building off of now? Like, if so much stuff was derivative from the stuff that
we
you guys
were building
built.
Off Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and the Ritz brothers and the Marx brothers. And we had all of that. And we kind of knew what good comedy was. Mm-hmm. And we knew what the rhythms of good comedy was, what the premises of good comedy was, because we had these hunks of art from the past.
Yeah.
And I'm sure when the Ritz brothers were doing their stuff, they had no idea that anybody would ever remember them, or they would. But they did about 10 years with 20th Century Fox. They were the comedy relief in all the Sonia Henie pictures. Sonia Henie was an Olympic star. She won a gold medal for ice skating, for figure mm-hmm. skating. And she became a 20th Century Fox star, Sonia Henie. And she was in movies with Cesar Romero and John Payne. And, you know. And the Ritz brothers, or they had... Fox, I worked for Fox for a long time, and every, I'll get to, you say,
sure.
Talk about the Fox graduates or yep. the Fox alumni, you know, in okay. a minute. But I was looking at, you know, all the Fox pictures, and they had two comedy relief items. One was the Ritz brothers, who got their stuff from Aaron Lebedoff and some kind of crazy Jewish comedy. You got to get a record called Romania mm-hmm. by Aaron Lebedoff. It's insane.
Okay.
And it is genius. It's pure. And the Ritz brothers just took it, stole it, and did their own thing with it. You know? And there was the Borominovich and his harmonica rascals with Johnny Puglio that kept hitting Boris Minovich in the balls, because he was very short. And when he'd always strike him in the balls. And so every time there was, I don't know, a Betty Grable or an Alice Faye or one of those Fox musicals, they needed comedy relief. If they couldn't get Jack Oakey in the frame in the middle of the movie, then they had these acts, and the two basic acts were the Ritz Brothers or Borominovich and the Harmonica Rascals.
Okay.
And often, the acts are the most more valuable than the storyline, and you know, and you know, and the emotional movie itself, you know, and to me, they're, and that those are my sources. I would go back to Borominovich, or I'd go back to the Ritz Brothers, and they lived in me, you know.
So talk about the Fox graduates now.
Every Friday, we meet at a restaurant. Alan Ladd Jr. Ran Fox. I'm almost right on the dates from the early 70s. I think he got the job in 73, like, yeah, 73 or 74. And I was trying to get a movie made, and Columbia was going to do it. And it was Young Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And Columbia said five. You know, they wanted to give me one. I remember exactly. Mike Gruskov, who's the producer. You just mentioned My Favorite Year. He also produced My Favorite Year.
Oh, okay,
Year.
Got it.
He's one of the the graduates that, you know, that we meet, the Fox graduates, we meet at a restaurant. But it started with Alan Ladd Jr., Laddie. Alan Ladd, the actor, his son.
Okay.
Looks a lot like him. And so Mike and Laddie and Freddie Fields, and they're all working at CMA with David Beagleman. And Laddie was picked to run 20th Century Fox out of that agency, out of that artist agency. Meanwhile, I'm dealing with the Schneiders and with other people and Mike at Columbia. And they like the movie. They like the script. They like Young Frankenstein. They want to do it. I've done the producers. I've done... What have I done? I've done the producers. I've done 12 Chairs. I've done Blazing Saddles. I know what movies cost. I don't know how they got to get made. So they're going to be 1.7. I said, I can't do it for 1.7. I can do it for 2. I can just about 2 million. You know, what do movies cost today?
50.
You know, what did Max's movie cost?
I don't even know.
200 million?
Probably,
Yeah. So... They give me a big fight, and they're not sure about it, and they'll get back to me for the 2, but I've got 1750 for sure. And as I leave the meeting at Columbia on Gower Street, I yell back through the open door, oh, by the way, it's going to be in black and white. Threw that over my shoulder. There's a lot of consternation in the form of, no, stop, wait, you know. And, you know, they all grabbed me by the collar, they threw me back, and we had a big, and I think one of them said, really funny, broke me up, said, Peru just got color. and I'll never forget hearing that, you know, Peru just got color, you know. So anyway... they said no, we'll give you the 2 million, you know, we'll give you the, you can make the, but it's got to be in color, we black and white. I mean, you know, I said it's like a salute to James Whale. It's like the, it's got to be, it's sweating stone castles and the monster's face would be green. I mean,
yeah.
It's got to be in black and white. That's the only way to do it properly. So they said no, we let's meet again tomorrow. Meanwhile, that night, Gruskoff, the producer, gets to Alan Ladd Jr., who's just been there for like a day and a half at Fox, gets him the script. They're up all night. He calls me in the morning, and Laddie says, we'll do it. What do you need? 2.5, 2.2, whatever you need, we'll do it. It should be in black and white.
Oh, good.
So I called Columbia, and I said, unless you give me an, you know, I want to be fairly fair, unless you give me an answer immediately that I get at least 2 million, and it's got, because I didn't, you know, negotiations, I just didn't want to pull out, and it's got to be in black and white. They said, we've been meeting all night, it can't be in black and white. We've got to pass. Yay! Yay, they pass, and Laddie, you know. So Laddie became my friend there and then. And I'll never forget later going to down to Alan Ladd's office and saying, I got an idea for a movie. It's a throwback to silent movies. We're going to call it Silent Movie. And he said, stop. Young Frankenstein, no color. Went back to, and now, no sound. He says, you know, what you know, what's next? You're going to just run, just show us cards and run off? You know? and anyway, I told him, what if I got stars? Just like we do in the movie. Just like I try to convince Sid Caesar in Silent Movie that if he invests money in the movie, we'll get stars to do the movie, and that'll save it from just being a silent movie. So I did the same thing earlier with Laddie. I said, what if I got Burt Reynolds or I got Paul Newman? He said, do it. Yeah, good. You know, we'll do it. So anyway, every Friday, Paul Mazursky, who was doing Unmarried Woman at the time, across the hall, and the same Mike Gruskoff we're talking about, who produced a lot of movies for me, and Lady Luck, something with Burt Reynolds, with Lady. He did a lot of movies for Fox.
Okay.
So there's Gruskoff, there's Laddie, There's Mazursky. There's Richard Donner, Dick Donner.
Sure.
Who did The Omen and
Superman.
Superman and Lethal Weapon, maybe mm-hmm. four of them. So he's a graduate of Fox, too. And Jay Cantor, who was kind of Laddie's right arm and left the agency with him. When Jay Cantor was with MCA, he handled, and they only wanted Jay Cantor. He's about 3'6". I don't know. He could walk, he like, my standard joke, he could walk under a coffee table with a hi-hat on. And he's the sweetest guy that ever lived. And some of his clients were Montgomery Clift, wow. Grace Kelly,
Jesus,
Marlon Brando, Marilyn Monroe, Warren Beatty. And they only wanted Jay Cantor. And when you meet him, you know why? Because he is the sweetest, easiest, smartest guy. You know, and always orders every week. He saved. I pay every week because The Producers was a big hit on Broadway, so yeah. I still have money from that. And he always orders a Cobb salad with blue cheese dressing. So
if we ever take him to lunch, we know exactly what we're in for.
Yeah.
Cobb salad with blue cheese dressing.
Yeah, and it's not expensive. Mazursky kills me. Mazursky, I'm not making this up. Mazursky always orders a rib steak, you know, big...
Five. I'll take five ribsticks.
Yeah. Big price. So anyway, we all meet every Friday and we talk. And like this, like we're talking now. Yeah. And I'm always saying, you know, it is. We can't look at it. I have the speech ready. Remember.
Mel, what'd you think about last week's lunch?
Yeah, right.
Isn't this great what we're doing right now? Don't talk about the moment.
Yeah.
Remember when last week's lunch was the greatest lunch ever? How do you, when you're, like, so... You're dealing with, like, the heads of all the studios at this point by the time you're doing Young Frankenstein. It feels like you don't have to go in and pitch to lower-level people like, okay, it's a black and white movie, it's a Young Frankenstein. But, you know, but going back further, you know, how do you get a movie like Blazing Saddles going? What was the germ of that?
That's good. That's a good question. I am going to choose to take the fifth.
Okay.
And have my constitutional rights. I'm not going to tell you anything about that.
Okay.
No, I've just changed my mind.
Okay, good. This worked out so well.
I'm going to tell you everything about
it. This worked out really well.
I just went on a mental journey and came back with it.
I've decided to tell you everything about it. So what about Blazing Saddles started with the outline of a movie called Tex X, created by Andrew Bergman.
Okay.
Now, you know who Andrew Bergman is?
No.
Bergman. Andrew Bergman. Andy Bergman has done... the Elvis picture. He's a terrific.
Okay, well then I know
director. And anyway, he was a writer in those days, and he had a great idea. He had an idea that a black sheriff comes into a white town, and he speaks Harlem 74, and they speak Western 1874. Mm-hmm. So that clash, you know, and I said, so how did it happen? I'm walking down the street, Beagleman sees me. I've done two movies and I don't have a nickel in my pocket. I'm broke. I've done The Producers, which just about, it probably made money, but we never saw it. And then I did The 12 Chairs, which nobody saw. Yeah. It's probably my best movie. Probably the best movie I made.
But isn't that kind of funny? And then we'll get back to the Blazing Saddles in a second. That as an artist or as a comedian, sometimes the things that you write that are your absolute favorite, like this is who I am, this is the best example of what I do, and for some reason it doesn't always.
Right? No, they don't agree. The world doesn't agree.
Why do you think that is?
The world says no. Your best movie is Spaceballs. That's what they keep saying. They keep telling me my best movie is Spaceballs, and. You know, and I say, no, you don't understand. It's The Prisoner of Zenda. Wait a minute. I didn't write that. No, I meant, it was The 12 Chairs, you know, which was a hell of a movie, which was a very good movie.
So Blazing Saddles, then.
So anyway, we started Tex-Ex. Biggleman says, have you eaten lunch? I said, not for days. So he takes me to the Sherry Netherland, this is in New York, and he buys me lunch, takes me back to his office. And he says, don't give me your routine. I know what your routine is because I always call you and you always say, I only do my own stuff, David. I'm not interested in working on anybody else's material. If it don't come out of my head, I'm not interested in doing it. So he said, just read this. Read this Andy Bergman thing. I think I can get it green-lighted. So I read it. And I say, it's good. I can't believe it. This guy, he's as good as I am. I can't believe anybody is as good as I am. So anyway, I said, I like it, and I'm broke. So he says, I think I could, what have you been making? I said, well, $50,000 a picture, but it's 4 years, so, I'm actually broke. And Anne was just pregnant with Max Brooks, mm-hmm. So, and I really knew I needed some money. I couldn't keep living on Anne. Anne would give me money under the table to pay for dinner. She would, and I would pay. And one time, we'd usually eat in Chinese restaurants. You could, for $10 or $15, you could have a big meal.
Yeah.
And usually you leave a $2 tip or $3 tip. It's a lot. So this time I felt expensive. She gave me money under the table. The bill was $14. I left a $5 tip, and she slapped me. She said, what are you being a big shot with my money? You're leaving such a big tip, It's a Chinese restaurant. So it was great. So Beagleman convinced me to do Blazing Saddles. And I said, I'll do it only if we do it like the Show of Shows, if I get a gang of guys like we used to write the Sid Caesar show. And everybody was yelling funny stuff or jokes or whatever, and I organized it. And I wrote it and directed it. So he called Warner Brothers and he got that deal for me. Wow. And there was a writing budget, altogether it must have been something like $100,000, mm-hmm. which was pretty good money in those days. And for $100,000, we got Andy Bergman. I took the original writer with me. Richard Pryor.
Oh my God.
Richard Pryor was one of the writers, a buddy of mine. We used to hang around the village together. And Norman Steinberg, who later wrote My Favorite Year, mm-hmm. with me and some others. And he was terrific. And he had a partner who was a dentist, who was funny. He went right back, did Blazing Saddles, got paid right back to being a dentist. He said, I don't show business. No good, I know. I know Novocaine. I know how to pull out a tooth. I know. The rest of it is scary and confusing. Show business. He didn't want to. He stopped being a writer. But Norman went on to write Johnny Dangerously. He wrote a lot of. Steinberg did some wonderful stuff, and he's still a buddy of mine. He just got married, again.
Oh wow!
Again, for the third time. I warned him against all the wives he picked, but this one seems to be all right.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Fair time's a charm.
So, and we all sat down and talk about Chinatown. We all went to 17 Mott Street at 2 in the morning. It was open all night, Chinatown. And so we would write until 12 or 1 in the morning, and then we'd go down to Chinatown. And usually it ended up with Andy, Norman, and I, and Richard was off doing something with someone. And anyway, I said to the group, this will never get done, but we're going to get paid for writing it. So let's just write something that we know no one would allow us to ever write.
It's actually a good place to come from when you're writing comedy, because then you're not constrained, and you can sort of pie in the sky and go, well, if we could do anything we wanted, what would it be?
So I said, this is a great premise. And we got a great little engine with this black and white thing going. So Pryor wanted to write Mongo, only Mongo. He was crazy. Yeah. Mongo only porn in Game of Life. Yeah. I mean, he was writing these crazy, I think Mongo's taking a liking. No, I'm taking a liking to you, Sheriff. Oh, no, Mongo's straight. He would write, Mongo would say, no, Mongo's straight. He'd write all these crazy Mongo things. And I would write all the black stuff. And then I would say, Richard, bless it. I got the N-word here. Thank you, bless it.
And he would say, okay.
He'd say, okay, okay. Yeah. Once in a while, he'd say, no, no, that's only for brothers.
Yeah.
He'd say that. Man, step too far. Okay, I want to take a step back. But he allowed me to say and do all those dangerous things, you know, vis-a-vis black and white, you know.
And then, so when you're actually shooting the movie,
yeah.
How much is the script pretty locked at that point, or is it Harvey Korman, or you know, or any of are people improvising?
It's so locked. It is so. There's little or no ad libs. Everybody thinks, oh well, we're you know. The only time in history of the world I let Gregory Hines go a little bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he just had a charming, wonderful, beautiful way of saying things. So there was the extra line, a word or two, that Gregory Hines would, you know, and the takes he would do. Like he says to Madeleine Kahn, he's supposed to be a palace slave,
yeah.
And he's pouring the Empress some wine. And says to her, say when? She says, 8:30. He does this incredible take, you know. And so anyway, but most of the time, everybody thinks, oh, what Mel Brooks, Wild and Woolly, Meshuggah, Wild, Crazy, no script, no, just Commedia dell'arte, run wild, you know. Every line, there's so much money to make a movie. You ad lib, and the cameraman doesn't know it. You ad lib and the lighting people don't know it and you're finished. It doesn't work. So you've got to ad lib a lot before you shoot it.
Well, especially in your movies where the jokes, there's a very specific mechanism that the
exactly.
rhythms have to play this and this and this and this and this. What time? 8:30. You know, then his yeah. it has to work a certain way.
Yeah. When Fritz Feld.
Yeah,
that guy says, push the mulled wine in history of the world. I'm a waiter at the Last Supper.
I remember.
I mean, we have to play back on that, and I have to push the wine. And Jesus says, yay, but one of you shall betray me this night before the dawn rises. And I say, Judas, do you want the mulled wine? So we go back. You know, yeah, everything is more or less more precise. It looks wild and crazy, but it has to be plotted very carefully.
Well, isn't that kind of a sign of good art, where it's sort of like it looks like it's spontaneous,
right?
But it's actually it's so meticulously built.
It's meticulously crafted.
Yeah,
that's what you were looking for.
That's exactly
meticulous and crafted work
yeah.
together.
Yeah,
I'll help you. For the balance.
Please, listen, if you would
balance
wanna,
of your language.
If you would just punch up my life, I would let you do that. If you would let
great.
Me do that.
I like that.
And Madeleine Kahn, too. Madeleine Kahn's another one like Gilda Radner, where it's like, I just, why couldn't you have lived longer to so that people, I mean.
So often I've said exactly what you said. Why couldn't you have lived longer, you know?
So just, flawless.
Yeah, I mean, everything she did, I allowed her to physically ad-lib a lot.
Yeah.
Like, her humming along with the song and just bending the key just wrong. Humming along with, I wrote the song, so you know, I would, you know, as a composer, you always want the song to be very precise and very, and be in the center of the note and not, you know. But when she hummed along with I'm Tired, she just missed. And it was so funny. You have to allow her. And then when she leaned on something to support her, and she missed that too, you know, she was just worth her weight in gold. You know
what's still really funny too is Cloris Leachman. Yeah. I interviewed her a couple years ago, and she's so, like, so amazingly sharp and funny. Nice. Like, just like a riff machine.
If you were smoking, she would have slapped the cigarette out of your mouth.
I was not.
Oh, you're lucky. She was dangerous on the set. Anybody who smoked, she ran over to and slapped.
Wow.
You know, she was crazy.
Is it true or is it not true? Years ago, someone said, oh, do you know Frau Blücher means glue factory in German, and that's why the horse freaks out.
I went with that. I think it's false, but I went along. It sounds great.
Right.
So I went along with it. But I'm not sure. I don't think Blücher means glue, but, you know, it sounds like glue.
I guess it'd be really easy to look that word up, but I just haven't.
I mean, what the hell? We're not in Germany. Who knows? we have rights.
But you know what's funny? What's interesting about what you do and what I feel like I see in your films is that you know, you dance into areas that people might say, oh, that's not politically correct to do that. But in effect, what you're doing is your films are like great cultural equalizers. Everyone's equal. Everyone's, and, you know, characters like black characters are the strong characters, are like in To Be or Not To Be, the whole idea of like smuggling the homosexual makeup artist out of Germany, you know, it's like everyone's equal. So even though you do dance into these waters of like, this could be considered, you know, politically correct, where it's like, yeah, but the ultimate message is that we're all equal and we can all laugh about stuff and these are the strong characters just as much as the other.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Oh, by the way, one of the, To Be or Not To Be, one of the little Jews in the cellar, little boy, is Max Brooks. He's not. He's
what?
Not, yeah, Max is 9 years old. And he says, "Thank you, Mr. Bronski."
Oh, that's adorable.
He's so cute. He had to be made up as a clown to escape because we were kind of a circus troupe escaping, and it was so tough to put all the makeup on him. He said, he confided in me, you know, after that picture, he said, "Dad," I said, "What, Max?" He said, "I'm not going to be an actor," because he never, you know. He said, "You have to do it again, and then they want you to do it again, and then again, you know, because you know it's always three or four takes."
Yeah.
And he didn't understand that we did that. You know, he said, "We got it." You know, he was nine; he knew better. You know, he could have saved us a lot of money if we listened to Max. You know, do it once, move on. You know, but so he never became an actor because he didn't. He just simply didn't want to get all that makeup on him and everything.
Yeah.
And he wanted to play, and you had to keep coming back and go to this phony baloney school. Like, you know, there was supposed to be a teacher on the set who was, the kids were smarter than the teacher. I was old. Anyway, we had a lot of fun. Max was one of the little Jews. And
was there any sense when he was like, "Mom, Dad, I don't want to be an actor," and you guys are like, "What?"
Yeah, no, I was pretty happy about it, you know, because it's a tough life. Getting a job as an actor is the toughest thing you can do.
Do you feel like it's easier to be a comedian in the sense that, because if you're an actor, it's not like you can just go act, but if you're a comedian, you can do stand-up, you can write.
You can make it up.
Yeah.
You can go to comedy clubs. No, a comedian has a much wider range of opportunity than an actor. An actor has to wait for a part, he has to audition, unless he's Tom Cruise or somebody, but if you're just, you know, it's a heartbreaking river of tears you see outside. They're lining up for one line or something. There's, you know, 132 actors. Yeah. It's just, it's, you know, you want to, I say, give them pumpernickel and butter. Give them something. Feed those actors. You know?
What do you think it is about, do you feel like comedy kind of breaks comedians a little bit, or do comedians come in a little broken? I've heard these stories about Sid Caesar, even on top of his game, where they would say, you know, "What do you do on your day off?" "Oh, I would just sit in the shower and shake," or, you know, you know, because he was so high strung and anxious. And what is that?
Yeah, well,
mechanism?
I mean, you know, it's difficult. It's all very hard to be kind of a in that stratospheric range of comedy. Sid Caesar and people, you know, he gave more than he had, and, you know, he was a brilliant comedy actor. He wasn't, the stuff came out of him. As a matter of fact, he raised, you know, he had the greatest writing staff, and he still raised the material.
Yeah.
He raised the material.
Who else was on the writing staff besides you?
Well, I mean, you know, to my left, Larry Gelbart, the greatest comedy writer that ever lived. To my right, Neil Simon, who wrote a couple of funny,
a couple of movies.
Funny plays, and behind me. There was Woody Allen, you know, for a couple of shows. There was people like Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof. There was our typist, our little secretary, redhead typist, Mike Stewart, wrote Bye Bye Birdie and Dolly and Mame. And, you know, I mean, he was just our typist. Nobody even spoke to him, you know. We would just say, "Get it down," you know. He was great. I mean, it was a remarkable writing staff, but you needed a lot of good writers, and you need a lot of writers, and still we only had five or six. I think my son was writing Saturday Night Live for a couple of seasons, mm-hmm. He said there were 18 writers.
Yeah, it's intense.
I mean, you know, and everybody begging to get their one or two jokes in, you know.
So was it true that it it's, you know, you're only, are you only as satisfied as your last joke kind of a thing?
It's kind of like that. I mean, you know, I mean, every, when you're doing, okay, listen, sitcoms today, what do? Do they do 16 in a season, I think?
Yeah, 16 or 22 yeah. or something.
We did 39 shows in a season, 39, and each one was an hour and a half with comedy guest sketches, with domestic sketches, with stand-up monologues, with pantomimes, with musical numbers, with an hour and a half.
Brand new every week.
Every week. A Broadway review every single week on television. And we were all burnt down, and especially Sid Caesar, who used to sit in the shower all day Sunday and shake. And just, you know, have the water tumble over him and, you know, and try to survive. I don't know how he did it. I'll tell you a story. I'm going to get some more water. I'll be right back.
Sure.
About me and Sid Caesar.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to get some more water. I'm going to get some water as well, if that's okay.
No. Me. I said I was the one.
Yeah, but I was.
Chris, there's bottles in the other room.
No, I want to do what Mel did. Oh, I'm getting a bottle of water. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you, Seth.
Look at all the bottles of water. We're
so
rich.
So much water.
We're water millionaires.
Okay. Oh, this is a true and very interesting story because I'll be the judge of what is true and interesting.
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, true.
Okay.
I can be the judge of true.
You could say Sid Caesar had wings, and then every Sunday he would fly to the desert, and I would say, great.
No, that wouldn't be true.
Okay.
But this is true. So we've done. Okay, let's go back.
Okay.
Can I have theremin music?
Wavy. Like theremin from the Beach Boys
yeah.
song, or just
no.
like a free?
Okay. No, theremin from. That's it. What was Spellbound? Spellbound theremin. Right. Good. That's enough.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just needed validation.
We're covered. We covered a lot.
Yeah, but I just want you to tell me my theremin's
really
good.
We went too far back, Chris.
Yeah. Okay.
So
forward theremin.
I'm talking. It is one of these Sundays. Sid, you know, I'm helping to dry off Sid Caesar from the shower, and I'm sitting with him. Ostensibly, he invites me up. He was living at 74th Street and Park Avenue. Nice apartment. And essentially to talk about the new, the next week and some ideas for comedy stuff. But it wasn't about that at all. I said, Sid, think of Red Skelton. Think of Bob Hope. Think of Danny Kaye. They're going to be around for a long time. Why? Because they make movies. And movies have a very durable and a very long life. Television is recorded on kinescopes, and they're paper thin, and sometimes they don't last. And sometimes if they're put on tape, the tape is erased so that they could, like...
No reruns.
I think it's when I did Johnny Carson, the very first Johnny Carson show, I was a guest. I was very funny. I think they erased the tape.
Ugh.
We can't find it. Mm. Some audio we found, but we can't find the tape. So I said to Sid, you've done two seasons. Your contract is coming up in 6 weeks. I knew exactly. I said, Sid, here's what I propose. Sid Caesar and Mel Brooks, we go out. I had been, during the first two seasons, I had been to Columbia. Someone tapped me, Freddie Colmar. Look at this, I'm almost 100. I still remember names. Freddie Colmar, producer at Columbia Pictures, brought me to see Jerry Wald, who ran their movie production. And Jerry Wald said, yeah, I think he could do it. They were going to do Pal Joey, a very famous Broadway show, and they were going to get Frank Sinatra to do it. So they brought me out to write it. And I came out, and... Hooray for Hollywood. Hollywood. I lived on Orange Drive right behind the, you know, and I saw Douglas Fairbanks' hand and right, you know, in the cement and his feet And I couldn't believe, you know, Marlene Dietrich, they were all there. I lived right behind the Chinese, the Grauman, you know, the Chinese theater on Orange. And so I said to Sid, I'm welcome. I could go out there. They'll accept the movie that I write. You are the biggest star on television. They're certainly going to accept. If I put together a movie, they're going to say yes, and we're going to do that movie. So, and I said that it's going to last. But you can't do that movie because you have 39 hour and a half shows to do. Which you know is literally soul searing. I mean, I don't know how you know. So he said, "You're right. Movies, take your time." I said, "You know, I could get some other writers. We could write a great movie for you, and I could direct it." He said, "But you've never." I said, "I can. I'm good. I can do it." He said, "I agree. Okay, that's what we're going to do. You will get them written, and you will direct them. I will star in them, and we'll make movies." And we shook hands, and we were going to do that. And this was, okay, 1953. We're going to make movies. So he tells Max Liebman, who was the producer of the Show of Shows, who in turn immediately, you know, his wig flies off. He wore a toupee. And his wig probably flew in the air. And he called Sylvester Pat Weaver, who was the genius who put together this thing called the Show of Shows, who was Sigourney Weaver's father.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
Pat Weaver. And so they go crazy. You know, they got a lot of sponsors. They got Sid Caesar booked, and, you know, but he hasn't signed for the third season. Third, fourth, and fifth seasons. And anyway, it's kind of cataclysmic. So I don't hear from Sid. We're still on hiatus for a little while. And I call him every day, and he can't. And then finally 2 weeks go by, and he calls me. "Mel, I can't do it. I'd like to, and you're right, and I know I'll regret it all my life," and he does regret it right now, to this day. He said, "I know I'll regret it the rest of my life, but I can't do it." He was making $5,000 a show, and they offered him, they finally convinced him, they gave him $25,000 a show.
Oh, my God.
1953.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's like being a millionaire. Literally. So he said, "I can't do it." He said, "Maybe down the line, you know, maybe there'll be other opportunities and we'll do it."
Well,
but we never got back to doing that. And I said, I knew that was my way out. And I finally ended up making movies. I started making them in New York, and I ended up making them in Hollywood.
But it's interesting that you still had, you know, when you talk about when Blazing Saddles came along, that was, you know, well over a decade later, and you still had all the ups and downs, and you, even at that time, you were like, "Oh, I was broke."
Yeah, I was, money didn't mean anything. You could exercise your, for want of a better word, art. You could exercise your dreams, your vision, and you know whether they worked for the audience or not, or for critics or not. You got them out of your soul, and they were there, and they were there forever, and they are still there forever. I made, you know, some of the dopiest movies ever made. They're there. They're there forever and ever. Silent Movie is a dopey movie. It's there forever.
I love The Critic, by the way, where it's such a simple idea of just this weird animation and what is this? Just the voiceover.
A little old Jewish man trying to make sense out of it, you know? And then people saying, "Hey, shut up. You shut up. I'm going to die soon," you know. I mean, stuff that's so real, you know. But there's nothing like, they have not come up in my life with anything better than movies. As far as I'm concerned, I still think movies are the best.
Do you get to the movies a lot?
I do, but I don't have to get to them.
They bring it.
I'm a member of the Academy. I get DVDs, and then I sell them later in China. I mean, it's perfect.
Max said that every night you still go hang out with Carl, and you guys.
Yeah, almost every night. I'm with Carl Reiner, and And we don't. We do very little reminiscing. We're just up to date. Sometimes we do reelies. I mean, it's just crazy. He will. He'll say, "I'm going to teach you." This is true. Carl will do this. Carl is crazy. Carl, he says, "I'm going to teach you how to describe the face, the human face, in French." I said, "Okay, okay, go." He said, "The chin, the chin." I said, "The chin." No, chin, chin, T Z I T Z I N, chin, chin. Okay, the chin. It's good. The cheek, cheek, D-Z-E-E-E-E-K-K-K. The cheek, okay, the cheek. He points to my cheek. Then he says, then no, the nose. I say, the nose. Finally, I know I have to do it like he does. Yeah. The nose, he's happy. I make him happy. Then, this is true. This happened like 2 weeks ago. And then he says, the eye, the eye, the eye. And he pushes just below my eye, and you know, it points to the eye. And I say, no. I said, no. He said, what mean you know? You know? I said, no, not that is not the eye. He said, that is the eye. I said, okay, that is not the eye. I said, what is the eye? And I put my finger on his eyeball. You know? I said, that is the eye. And he was, so it was, I ran for a little while, you know. But we both were hysterical, you know. So we do, and we do that just for ourselves. Just comedy for, you know, entre nous, you know. Just for us. So we still hang out, and we watch stuff. Carl says he'll only watch a movie if it has dialogue in it, like, Secure the Perimeters. He likes Secure the Perimeters. And he also likes, he's pretty brilliant, he also likes Try to Get Some Rest. Sure. He says, if it has Try to Get Some Rest and Secure the Perimeters.
So just cop movies?
Then, yeah. Then,
there's an apocalypse movie, Try to Get Some Rest.
Right. So we like the Bourne movies, we like those. Try to Get Some Rest. He likes, you know, it's in almost every bad movie. And so I see him, you know, he hasn't lost much. I mean, physically, he's not, you know, he's not Carl Reiner anymore. He's a little bent. He's, you know, he's slower. He takes a lot of different, you know, things for, you know, for his pressure and stuff like that.
But he's still the same guy.
But he's still basically the same guy. And we, you know, and I encourage him. I'm probably going to kill him. I encourage him to eat bratwurst and beans and sauerkraut and, you know, and potatoes. And
he should enjoy his life.
Exactly. He's going to be 91. What's the sense of being on a strict diet now?
I mean,
I said to him, Carl, take 3 years off your life and die happy. You know?
Right.
You know, it's better. It makes more sense. Eat what you want.
Do you still feel the comic gene? Like, do you want to perform? Do you have a desire to do that anymore?
I do, once in a while. Where's my hat? Where's my hat? Where's my hat? Here's my hat. Here's my hat. Where's my hat? And there it is. Here's my hat. Do I have the... Do I have the comic gene? I Thursday night?
I couldn't help but notice your hat says Jimmy Kimmel Live. Were you recently on the program?
Thursday night. Last Thursday night. I was on, and I was pretty good. Pretty funny. I was pretty funny. I broke him up anyway.
Oh, that's good. What did you talk about the DVD, the new DVD collection?
No, I you know, I eschewed salesmanship because I thought that was in questionable taste. So I left that to him, but I kept pointing to the box set, even though I didn't talk. I would, yeah. And he did. He kept pushing it. He kept pushing the box set, you know. He'd throw it up for the camera to see. But I did a lot of, you know, not necessarily stuff for the box set or in the box set, but I did some really strange and funny things. Because he asked me, what was the most embarrassing moment, you know, you've ever had on a show in public? And I said, I don't even have to think. I know. I mean, it haunts me. It's like 30, 40 years ago. It's to this day I get shivers thinking about it. It's the most embarrassing thing that ever happened. He said, well, what? I said, I was on a show with Julia Mead. She was my partner on some kind of, you know, quiz show. And it was called I Guess. And the host, you're a little young for this, the host was a wonderful, the best quiz show host that ever lived, Bill Cullen.
Oh, I know who
crew
he is.
Cut and the black horn-rimmed glasses, you know. And fast and sweet and funny, and he could make those shows move along. And so we were an I Guess, and it was an interesting show, and I kept doing kind of, I was a bad boy, and I kept doing, you know, the Mel Brooks ad-libs and bad stuff, you know. No dirty words, but edging. I was edgy, you know. And so the show was over, and the audience had laughed a lot, and he yelled from his little, he always was behind a little desk, a little dais, and, you know, and he yelled, Mel, funny, so funny. Here, give me a hug. And he left. This is true. You can't, you know, you won't be able to hear this because I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And he said, yes, it's true. Obviously, in all the 100 different shows, he's like the dais on a little desk is up to here. And so he gets from behind it and he says, Mel, give me a hug.
Oh. So,
and he's doing this crazy walk, you know? And I say, oh, and I say, oh, Jerry Lewis, we're doing Jerry Lewis.
Oh, no. Now, oh, no.
He's a physical comic.
No.
He loves physical comic. So I say, oh, Billy, oh, Billy. And Julia Mead's screaming after me, he's crippled, he had polio. Oh. He had polio, he's crippled, don't do it. And I'm doing, I'm saying,
secure the perimeter.
Yeah, and I'm saying, yeah, too late. I did it.
You have to commit to it at
I
that
did,
point.
Yeah. But I did it on Kimmel, and the audience, everybody went crazy.
Oh, my God.
The audience went wild.
Did it feel, when you were doing Kimmel, did it feel like, oh, I got to do this more often?
Yeah, it did. As a matter of fact, I'm pushing this box set. So I haven't been on TV for a while, and I am going to do Conan.
Oh, good.
November 27.
Okay, great.
Tuesday, right.
That's and next week. Yeah, we'll put
it. I'll do the same, exactly the same things, because I think no one who watches Conan watches Kimmel. I may be wrong.
This could be true.
It could be true, but either you're a Conan fan or a Kimmel fan. But you can't just watch them both, can you?
No, it's
never.
Impossible.
No, no.
We just don't have the technology to even accomplish such a feat.
Right.
What do you think?
Wait a minute. I think that's stupid.
What are you talking about?
No, I thought it was going to a different channel.
No, you just, but you only get one channel in your home now. It's just one channel, right? And you get to pick whatever channel that is.
You guys don't have to sign the late night contract. I can only legally watch one.
Right. It's a partisan system of television now. You can only go with one or the other. You can't possibly.
So how many people, how do people hear Nerdist or see Nerdist or hear Nerdist or what?
They download it on the internet or listen to it on iTunes or whatever.
So, like, you have a channel?
Well, we have a YouTube channel, but
website.
We do have a website, and then the podcast is available on iTunes as well. So most people get it from iTunes. Some people just download the
iTunes
file directly.
iTunes doesn't pay anything.
No. They're just a platform.
They don't pay you.
No, they're a platform. They're like a television set. They basically just deliver the content to people.
Right. If we were military people, we'd say delivery system.
Delivery system, yes.
Right.
Yes.
You know.
It's an important delivery system.
Yeah, but
and then I would say get some rest.
Right. Try to get some rest.
I'm sorry. I already fucked that up already. Hey, man, damn it.
You got to get it right.
I know. I messed it up. But yeah, and so that's how most people get it. And it's great because they, you know, where
do they write in to you? Do they say,
they do.
I liked it? Or, I mean, did they
do
that kind of?
Yeah.
They tell us when they didn't like
they
it.
They were very vocal about
mostly
that.
Mostly when they don't like it.
We're pretty lucky. I think it's like, I honestly think we're like 80-20. Like 80% of the stuff we get is very positive, and 20% are, why are you doing that, and why don't you do something different, rather than
well,
just
well, basically, you four people, are you basically the guts of it, the center?
Yeah.
The nucleus of the show?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So we do. I do some of them alone because these guys have jobs and they can't always come with me. But for the most
other
part,
jobs.
Yeah. A comedy writer.
Joel was writing on the. I mean, Joel. Jonah was writing for Joel McHale on the Soup for a while, and then Matt was working at a channel called G4 writing.
Oh yeah, I know G4 because we did
Spaceballs animation.
Spaceballs animation.
Yeah, I'm on Attack of the Show over there.
So what are you working at G4? What are you doing at G4?
Attack of the Show, which is
but his network's about to go away. G4's about to
get rebranding.
It's totally changing. Attack of the Show got canceled.
Right now we're canceled. Our last show is the 21st of December, and then they're relaunching it to some sort of.
So what's G4 going to be?
I hear it's going to be something along the lines of Esquire or GQ.
It's
magazine.
The male eyebrow grooming network.
Yeah, they're calling it we're calling it Bravo around the
it's
office.
It's Bravo. Yeah,
it's going to be Bravo. For
you, you must have some advice for Matt Myra. He's you've worked on stuff that didn't make it. You how do you deal with it?
You know, there's no advice for anybody.
Thank you, Mel.
Really? You know, you can't give anybody advice.
No.
I mean, what you do has to basically emanate from somewhere in you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the only advice you could give is once it's out, once you've vomited, express it, either, in a scenario of some kind or a script or an idea that you write down, and then the next best thing to do once you've written something is get an agent. Because agents know they're dirty. They're dirty. They're really dirty. They know all the dirty tricks. They know
they're pimpy.
Yeah. And they'll say, oh no, don't send it to his second assistant. They know everything. How to get to a studio executive's desk the right way and my advice always, I've been in the business, what, 74 years?
Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's actually only 54 years, but it sounds good. But my advice to you, to comedy writers anyway, who want to write movies, who want to write TV shows, I say get, if it's going to be, if you have a movie in mind, get it to the actor. Get it to the star. Don't ever send anything to a studio. Because they'll have somebody dopier than you reading it before it gets to a low-level other dope. And, and it'll never get anywhere. So my advice always is see if you can have a friend of the star,
mm-hmm,
who knows, and befriend him. Buy him chicken lo mein. Buy him things.
And leave a $5 check.
Become his friend. And then he has to, you've got to get to the actor.
Okay.
If the actor likes it, then the actor's agent says, I don't know, this guy's never written anything, I don't know, The actor says, yeah, but the conversation goes something like, yeah, but I like it. I could do this. I like that character. I like the thing he wrote. Then that's the muscle for in a movie to get to a studio. If Anne Hathaway likes it, you got a chance of it getting made. If Steve Carell likes it, you got a chance of it getting made.
They were both in Get Smart.
Yes. I only subliminally push my own stuff, Good for you. Chris Hardwick, 2 points. Dunk. Yeah. Well done.
How do you, as a comedy writer, how do you break past the wall? Like when you're writing and your brain feels like, I don't have another joke to squeeze. I don't know where the sketch is going to go. I don't know how this is going to end. Do you pull away or do you push through?
I push through. I mean, I always did. It's a habit. I did it on the Show of Shows.
You had to then.
We were exhausted, it was a live show. It was literally live. Everything today is live, but it's not.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of taped. Just
live to tape, they call it.
Yeah.
Attack of the Show is still live.
But we were.
For two more
really?
Weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
It was
it's
truly
seven,
live?
7 to 8. It's still live, yeah.
Two more weeks.
Just ad lib?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. I'm hosting it next week and live, and we'll see.
So it's going off the air. Why?
Because they're just canceling all the programming they have, and they're going to rebrand.
Can it go anywhere else?
I don't know.
What about a website? Its own.
What about the Nerdist YouTube channel? Well, the problem is that it's all about licensing, and it's owned by NBC.
Yeah.
And it's like, even though, and it's one of those companies where you go, hey, can I just keep making that thing? And they'll go, no. And you're like, but you're not even using it. And they're like, well, but I'm in business affairs, and you can't have that.
I know.
It's everything's it's like, too corporatized.
Yeah, Seinfeld. I said, well, do you own the show? He said, well, Because he came over and he did something with me and
the
Carl.
The Comedians and Cars Getting Coffee.
Yeah, yeah, Getting Coffee. And I said, I love that kind of stuff. I really love that. Mm-hmm. Easy, you know. And you talk about serious stuff, about life and death. You talk about a lot of stuff, and some of it's pretty funny. And he said, no, it's on a network, little network called Crackle. It's owned by Sony. So you're right. In the end, it's always owned by NBC. You know, no matter what, you can trace it. You know, there's always one big owner, and it's, you know.
So you were just about to say a second ago about pushing through the wall, the writing barrier.
Yeah, but you do. You can. You. Well, there are things today that I really admire. Self-publishing. Mm-hmm. You can publish your own book, or you can create a network. And just do a lot of dopey things, and it'll be on your own little website.
Yeah.
You know, your own little, you know. It can be done, and you can be discovered, you know. You don't have to take shit from anybody.
Because you definitely did, I mean, you did have very much of the philosophy of what kind of drives creativity now, which is you go, well, I'm just going to make my own stuff. You figure out how to push it through. It's certainly a lot easier now because people can make their own stuff. And you don't have to have a studio give you the platform, exactly what you were just saying.
Right. The trick is to attract people to see it and to talk about
There's
it.
There's a lot of noise now, especially because everyone's making shit all the time.
Yeah, right. And they're always, you know. But a couple of things come through, always, you know. You know, there's a lot of funny stuff that... I still go to comedy clubs.
What? Where do you go?
You know, I go to the Improv, and I go to the Comedy Store, and... You know, on Sunset. I hang out in the back, you know.
Where do you fall in terms of, because I'm not a dirty comedian, but I do say a lot of kind of filthy things. Like my brain goes right to the vagina a lot, and I hate that about myself. And so I'm trying to be comfortable with it, because I feel like, no, if I were really funnier, I wouldn't write. I wouldn't always go there.
Yeah.
But do you just sort of feel like, no, you just express what you express, and you should just be happy with that.
Yes, you said it. I say sick. I vote for two.
Okay, good.
I vote for what you said secondly.
Okay.
You know, right? Yeah, go where you go normally, where you go, you know, naturally.
Because people must have given you shit in the 70s.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh. Wow. I mean.
Max said you punched a critic once.
I did. There was a. How did he remember that? There was a. Okay, I'll tell you the guy exactly. Everything. So there's a guy from. It was a very in magazine at the time, Q-C-U-E.
Okay.
A New York magazine that had to do with entertainment. It was like Entertainment Today kind of. Q magazine. And it had a good critic at the time. William Wolfe was its critic. And so William Wolfe came to Yugoslavia when we were shooting The 12 Chairs. And I showed him around, you know. And we went. I said, you know, it's Q magazine. Come on, give him the white meat of the chicken. You know what I mean? we'll take the dark. You know, and, you know. And we were very good to him. I mean, he was there with us. He was embedded. You know, he was embedded with the 12 Chairs Company in Dubrovnik, in Belgrade, in Novi Sad. And you know, he was with us. He was like, even though he wasn't in the movie, he was still part of it. We were very good to him. So we get back. The movie's released, and it gets mixed reviews, which was pretty good for my second one. The first one got all bad newspaper reviews. Renata Adler, the critic, she thought the producers was terrible.
What?
New York Times. Really, she thought it. And she said, the leading man is fat. I just couldn't believe it.
You should have put that on the poster.
Yeah. But anyway, look at the poster. But Time and Newsweek, all the magazines were great. So we survived. You know, the magazines saved us. Then I did 12 Chairs. Pretty good reviews. Semi, you know. And the worst review, this is true. The most devastatingly bad review we get for the 12 Chairs is from Q Magazine.
Oh, no.
From William Wolfe.
Oh, no.
He said, I'm bitterly disappointed, you know. He said, I was there watching. He said, I thought of it. Maybe it was the editing. Maybe. He said, but it's practically an unwatchable, boring picture. I mean, it was just like the worst review you ever read.
Sounds like a blogger.
In your life. And it was my, you know, and I said, okay. I wasn't sure about staying in movies with the producers after Renata Adler and the Times. I figured, oh, I was making a living in television. I better go back. But, you know, somehow we survived. And the producers ran a little bit. And here's the 12 chairs, and this guy kills. I said, well, I'm back to Get Smart. I bet Get Smart, too. Here I go, you know. And I'm having dinner with Ann and at the Russian Tea Room. And I remember that I was having blinis with the red caviar and sour cream. And in the middle of a blini bite, and in walks William Wolfe. And he stops by and says, hi, Mel. Hi, Mel. Hi, Mel. So I grabbed him. I went crazy. I went berserk. I grabbed him by the collar and his tie and his and I shoved him hard. And unfortunately, the back of his head hit the spout of a samovar, which was on a shelf against the wall. You know, bang, and he started to bleed. And then we took our handkerchiefs out, and we all had his, but you know, and then but he didn't have me arrested or anything. But I really
different time,
much different time.
You know, I just couldn't. You know, I had no choice. The animal in me rose. You know,
but you don't seem to me to be. You seem like a pretty easy guy to work with, and I remember
working. I'm fine.
I remember watching when Gene Wilder was on Inside the Actor Studio years ago. He said Mel and I only ever had one argument. It was this knockdown, drag-out fight about a joke, and then you stormed out. And he said you came back in after you screamed at him and said, "Who was that crazy person who was just a second ago?"
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was all about putting on the Ritz, and I said, "Look, I'm the first one to be anarchic and crazy and tear, but this will tear." This is going to tear it. This is going to tear Young Frankenstein. We're going to make, you know, the kind of James Whale's master. We're going to make it silly. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make it silly. I want to give it, you know, I'm not in it. Therefore, I'm not even doing a part of it because of you. Gene said he would only do it if I wasn't in it.
What?
Yeah. He said, if you're not in it, I'll do it.
Why would he say that?
Because, you know, I would be in a... I could be in like a, I don't know, a knight's helmet and the gamma go, but hiya, folks. You know? he knows, you can't trust me. So I said, I won't be in it. But he was tearing it with putting on the Ritz.
So you didn't want putting on the Ritz in there?
After we had done it, I said, we've gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, let's film it. And see, you know, and then we'll see how it fits. We had this big like knockdown drag out, you know, and I did it. We did it. Oh, I came back to him. I said, "Okay, we're gonna film it." He said, "Why?" I said, "Well, you were so passionate about it. It might have some worth. I don't know. I mean, you believe in it so much, so we did it." I said, "For sure, we're probably gonna take it out," and we did it, and I. With tears in my eyes, I hugged him later after I cut it and said, it's the best thing in the movie.
Oh, that's sweet.
And it was. It was the best thing in Young Frankenstein.
Did you find that hard, like, being like making a parody of a movie, like where to stay kind of true to the type of movie you were parodying, and then trying to not get lost inside of that, where it's like if someone says a joke, you go, nah, but if it was that movie, that no one would say that.
Right.
And kind of get lost in the parody.
Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, you're just the same thing happened with High Anxiety. You've got to faithfully, you know, you got to respect, you got to love the movie you're having fun with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I loved Westerns. I mean, they saved my life when I was a little kid. I was able to forget poverty or tenements or whatever, you know, and I'd be lost in sagebrush and, you know, and a white horse with, you know, with a white hat and... lovely stuff like that, and so as much fun as I made of the Western, it was to me a salute to the great genre of film, you know, The only one I didn't have enough respect for was Spaceballs, was the sci-fi, because it was too new, because it wasn't legendary like the James Whale horror films, or, you know, or the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers beautiful, you know, gorgeous musicals, you know.
Right.
So I wasn't as faithful to the walls and the floors and whatever of Spaceballs as I was to the other movies. Even Robin Hood, I saluted in a strange way. I was very careful about their costumes. I broke it a little bit. There were a lot of different actors that applied for the part of Achu. A-C-A. who was Robin Hood's kind of right-hand guy, you know, his sidekick. And I saw this young guy, very young, who had a sweetness and comedy timing that was terrific, and I spotted it. And there was Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
So I got him, and you know, and he was wonderful in the movie. He has a scene he does so beautifully. When it's a classic scene where Robin Hood and Little John meet on a small bridge, and Dave Chappelle says, hey Robin, no big deal here. Look, I'm on the left bank. Boom, I'm on the right bank. I'm on the left. See, he keeps jumping over this tiny stream. He said, you know, we could simply just walk around it. No problem. We don't have to fight for the rights of the bridge, you know. And he said, it's the honor, you know.
It's the principle.
It's the principle of the thing or something. Look. That's wonderful. Jonah and Matt. I mean, it was Jonah, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, but I mean, he was good at everything he did, Dave Chappelle.
Right? Yeah, he's great.
And I'm sorry, I don't know what happened to him. I mean, I wrote him a couple of, you know, he's like in showbiz, he's out of showbiz. It depends on... on how he's...
I'm sure he's somewhere doing a five-hour set.
Yeah.
I saw him in New York a couple, like, maybe three weeks ago, and I didn't say hi to him because I just didn't... I know, do you have that thing where you go, oh, I sort of know that person, but then you play it out in your head and you go, well, I'm going to walk up and I'm going to say hi, and then they're going to say hi, and then there's going to be an awkward moment, and we don't really have anything to talk about, and I'm going to leave. So yeah. I'll just skip the whole thing.
Yeah, no, that was smart. That was I thought that was wise of you. You know? That would... Exactly, that's the scenario. That would have happened.
Yeah.
So it may happen here now.
No.
I'm not sure. I know who the hell you are, Chris Hardwick.
I'm going to start getting a
table. If you weren't a friend of my son, Max's, you'd have no chance of being here at this point.
So glad this worked out then. I'm so glad this worked out.
I like your title very much.
Oh, thanks.
Artist. I really think it's great.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, you know, ashamed of... Au contraire.
Exactly.
I love that. Au contraire. No, we're going with it.
You know, the funny
thing.
We're
all nerds.
It's sort of like the nerd thing was, it's sort of a buzzword now, but really when I was growing up, it was not a cool thing to do. Like, there was definitely an element of, like, trying to take it back because I was so ashamed of everything that I was into when I was a kid. And I just,
really?
Yeah. And I just want people to have to live that way. So, you know, I think there's a little bit of like, no, be proud of what you like. It's okay. Like, yeah. don't be ashamed.
That's good. That's all good stuff.
It's kind of a hug message.
Yeah.
What is the, just before we let you go, because you've been super great to sit with us here.
I didn't give you anything to eat or anything.
No, I got water.
You got water?
Okay. You did get water.
We are wealthy with water. I could stay hydrated for 6 hours.
Just we're also squatting in your office.
Yeah, exactly. There's a piano here. Katie's going to get on the piano. We're going to do Fabulous Baker Brothers numbers in a minute.
I really would have liked some food to wash this water down.
Jonah, you're a legend to all of us, and Jonah in particular, but Jonah would be the one guy who's like, yeah, but he didn't give us food.
Yeah,
I mean, you know.
It won't be the same when I'm watching the movie.
It was really great of you. But what do you think is the, and this may be too pretentious a question to ask, and so don't answer it if you don't want to, but what do you sort of, what do you think is this kind of the essential element of comedy? Because if you read the book on the DVD collection, it says, you know, the Jews had so many horrible things happen to them, basically, that one out of every 10 Jews has to stand up and make everyone laugh.
Yeah.
Is the essential quality of comedy suffering, or is it dealing with horrible things? Or when you think about comedy, what do you think?
That's a really good question. There's no good answer. I would say one word, if I were to define it, I would just say protest.
Oh, that's interesting.
Comedy is protest. It's, you know, not things as they are, but rather more as they should be. So I and it's just it's the essence of protest, you know. So comedy is, you know, I beg to differ, or you know, if you're fancier, if you're just Jewish, you say, no, listen to this.
When I was a kid, I wanted to convert to Judaism because I wanted to be a stand-up. When I was a really little kid, I would see like the Show of Shows special they did on PBS, where all of you guys were talking in front of the red curtain. And I was like, oh, I think I have to be Jewish. Yeah. And I tried to let my mother let me convert. And she went along with it for a little while. And then slowly it was
like, that's a lot of work.
You know what? You're staying in Catholic school.
Yeah. I did it the easier way. I just told people I was Canadian.
Yeah. Canadian is good too.
Yes. Yeah.
Canadians.
Then you're out of everything. There's no, you know. Everything goes by.
Oh, I can't be mad at him. Yeah. He's Canadian.
Yeah, right.
You sort of, I kind of like to think of Dick Cavett as the forefather of podcasting in the sense that, you know, talk shows now on television are so much, hey, you worked on the thing. That was great. Really? Okay, we got to go to the, we got 4 minutes with you. But Cavett, you watch those specials and you did the show. Like, he just lets it breathe and there's a conversation and you guys talk. Like, what do you think it is? What is it about Dick that you think makes him so great?
I have a new one coming out on December 10 at HBO with Alan Yentob, who's a creative. He's been a friend for a long. He's the creative director of the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And he has nothing to do with news. He has nothing to do with sports, but he has everything to do with entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been a friend of mine ever since he was the kind of assistant on a show called Arena, BBC, about 30 years ago. And he came here and did a, what was it was called? I Thought I Was Taller, about me.
Okay.
And it's in the box set. It's very funny.
Oh, that's cool.
It's on the BBC, and it's a... It's a kind of doc. It's a faux documentary, on Mel Brooks, the producer.
Yeah.
And you know, it's there's some very funny stuff in it because I have a very big office and I'm just, you know, waxing eloquently about my work and Brooks films, and Sherry comes in. She was running Fox at the time, and she comes in and says, "I need my office back." And I said, "Okay, okay." And then cut to, and we'll go to my office. And we're in the hall in a broom closet with a sink. And I keep talking as if, you know, as if I was still running Fox. You know, it's stuff like that. It's really wild, you know. And like I'm coming to my real office, and there's all Alan's stuff. Is in the hall, and I say, "What is this shit? Get it, clear it out. I'm gonna have a, you know, I'm gonna be interviewed. I can't, you know." He says, "Well, this is the stuff. Oh, I beg you. Oh, please, litter my floor." You know. So we did a lot of stuff that was very funny, and it'll be out December. No, not that. That's in the box set. But Alan, like Dick Cavett, very easily, casually asked me questions about my life. It's more Proustian.
Mm-hmm.
About memory and smells and stuff, and Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and I like it. It's not so belly laugh hit, you know, hit hard.
That's right. You're from Williamsburg before all the hipsters moved in.
$18 a month rent. Now it's what, $3,800 a month? Same apartment. I mean, really, it's.
I think it'd be fun to go through and find your old apartment and just knock on the door and go, "Hi, I'm Mel Brooks. Yeah. I used to live here. Can I just look around?"
Yeah. We were talking about you changing, trying to be a Jew.
Yeah,
I wanted to
be a Jew, yeah.
Shelby.
Yeah.
Do you have a kit?
Shelby.
I've needed one all funny. This time.
Yeah. Shelby,
give me a yarmulke.
Is there a way of playing the thing with Carl Reiner's Lifetime Achievement, the George Slaughter Comedy Awards? How can we play that?
We could just play it, and then if I have the file, I can just input it on to the end of the.
But I want you to see it with me now.
Yeah, okay. I'll watch it. We'll watch it.
Because it has a lot to do with Jews, being a Jew in comedy, and, you know. Carl Reiner was being given, there was a thing called the Comedy Awards George Slaughter had. He did Laughing. He was a great producer. And he did these, you know, just, I guess, to make money, you know. It was a good show. The American Comedy Awards.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever.
On the Steve Martin box set, he has his clips from there when he was...
And nobody respected it, so it was very funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's kind of like the Comedy Central Comedy Awards now, where it's just like, you know, it's people on Comedy Central shows getting awards from Comedy Central. What an honor.
Yeah. That's brilliant. So, 1991 American Comedy Awards. I want you to see this one.
Okay.
No salute to Carl Reiner or his career would be complete without a few words from his illegitimate son, Mel Brooks.
I'm all right. I'm all right. Well, let's tell the truth, huh? The truth is, ladies and Jews, you know the truth. The truth is, I don't know if he deserves this, do you? A lot of people don't agree with this. I'd like to cut right now. Cut outside and see the demonstration against Carl Reiner. Go, cut out. Have you got the tape? Cut outside now. Let's see the truth. Damn it. Let's see it. Where's the tape? Where, run. Where is it? Look, look, look. That's the truth. That's what's really happening here. Yes. And wait a minute, wait a minute, and now, while we're telling the truth, let's tell it all. For 25 years, he made me out to be the 2000, to be this Jewish person. And there was money in it, and I went along with it. Hold it, hold it. And now, tonight, here, in this stupid place, I'm gonna reveal. I am really a Gentile born in Waco, Texas. This is not my nose. Look, look carefully. Watch. Watch me. This is 25 years I'm wearing this nose. I've put up with this. And now, damn it. God damn it, I can talk the way I always talk when I lived in Waco. I don't have to do that Jew talk no more. I love you.
I can't. That's the best. That's the best I've ever seen.
It was worth it. It was worth it. Oh, God.
That was awesome. That's a great bit.
Yeah.
Does it make you... Do you sort of have that thing that Jack Benny and George Burns had where it's like you love making him laugh?
Right. I love making him laugh. And I do. I can get him so easily.
Can he get you?
No. I never let him get me. But every once in a while I cave in. I can't help it. But I thought that was
amazing.
Great, you know.
Yeah. The prosthetic nose.
Yeah, right. I love that. Just.
You see Dick Van Patten in the background. Yeah.
I saw Frank Langella there, a bearded Steve Martin.
Yeah. All right, so now what do you want to know?
Oh, good. We're actually going to start the podcast.
What's the fastest
now?
Way to be Jewish?
is there a genre that you haven't kind of gone after that you still wish, like, oh, I really want to, there's one that I never got to that I really want to get to?
Well, I was wondering, during my life in showbiz and entertainment, was there a genre that began and flowered and blossomed during my life, you know? And I don't know, I think it may have been podcasts, you know? Maybe that's the next
thing. Or porn,
thing.
Podcasts or porn.
Right, maybe that's the next thing I should have fun with.
Well, I hope you do. I mean, listen, if you ever want to play around with like short form stuff, you know, we have a YouTube channel and I would produce anything you wanted if you wanted to do fun stuff.
Okay.
Just to screw around.
Is there any money in it?
Mel, there's a lot of... There's a lot
there's
of
little
hugs.
Little or no money in this stuff.
There's a lot of hugs. Yes.
Satisfaction.
Yeah.
We'll give you 1.75.
Well, this was fun. This
was amazing.
You can watch the on the 10th of December. It's not part of the... It'll be part of maybe two. Maybe I really will make it two.
Yeah.
And it'll be part of two. It'll be the Alan Yentob interview.
Cool.
And we cover a lot of stuff.
Is there anything
just sort of as we kind of wrap it up, is there anything when you, because a lot of times I feel like when you're making stuff, you don't really necessarily think about what you're trying to say. And sometimes you look back and you go, oh, I guess that's what my brain was trying to say. And I didn't realize it at the time. So when you look back at all the stuff you made, is there anything that you feel like you've learned about yourself because of what you've expressed over the years?
You know, that's a, you know, that's a very good question. I have no answer for it. I have no, you know, I need to think. Okay. I'd have to think. I couldn't be that glib. I couldn't say, oh yeah, when in 1958 when I, you know. No, there probably have been times, maybe in the middle of making a film, when I said, wait a minute, there's another direction I could have or should have taken, you know. But that's a very, you know, I give you a gold star for a good
question. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Well, it's great to see you. And again, I, you know, I mean, we try not to geek out on you too hard, but, you know, you're one of the reasons why we all do what we do, you know, like a whole...
I'm so lucky, you know, I'm so lucky that my anarchy has been accepted because I had no choice. I am a comedy anarchist, and, you know, my stuff is basically my modus operandi, my path is to destroy things, you know?
Yeah.
It's to hurt, you know? It's, well, actually, all comedy, you know? We're all comics and comedy. We whisper into the king's ear. We tell the king who's no fucking good.
Yeah.
You know, what the truth is, you know? And it's good, and it's really important, you know, to tell America and the world how you feel about, you know, existing things and issues that, you know, that on the surface is accepted by society. And we know it's bullshit. And we got it. Who said it the best? I think Richard Pryor. He always pointed to what was phony baloney, you know. And I think he was he could have been the best stand-up comic of them all, you know.
Yeah. More particularly that, you know, between Carlin and Pryor.
Oh yeah, right. He's on it, hot on his heels. Carlin is
that it's
fabulous. The truth.
Yeah.
Carlin's essay on stuff is worth worth your life. You know.
You ever notice how other people's stuff is shit? Other people's shit is stuff. What is it? Your stuff is shit, and their shit is stuff.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I probably fucked that up.
You got it backwards, but. It's right, and I mean there were a lot of guys like that. Even Cosby, in a quiet way, was beautiful. His family stories are fabulous, you know. But like I said to Sid, you know, and I see Sid every other Friday or so. Sid's he lives up in the hills of Beverly Hills, and he has some kind of, I don't know what it is. I mean, it's kind of synaptic problems where. It's not exactly muscular dystrophy or anything you could name, but it's difficult for him to put a fork into a piece of food and bring it to his mouth. He can talk and he can laugh. It's all slow and it's all garbled, but he gets it. And sometimes Rudy DeLuca, one of the last pictures I did, Life Stinks. He's a wonderful actor and a wonderful writer. And he's been, since Silent Movie, he and Barry Levinson have been writers with Ron Clark. And Rudy and I go up there. And he cries with joy when we tell him what we remembered, how much we loved it and how... And he did a thing called "I've Got $5 and It's Burning a Hole in My Pocket," and if you can get him on the right track, he will sing it again in a very garbled and strange way. But he'll sing "I've Got Fire Burning a Hole in My Pocket," and he'll be on key and he'll be so, and just performing again. Even he can't get out of bed in his bed, and so we know, Rudy and I know, we cry, we hold each other and cry later. But we know that he's been, you know, we know that Sid Caesar was about the best comedian that ever lived. Yeah. Well, we think he was anyway, you know, in our lives. But, and so I'm blessed. I'm blessed, and I just got lucky that, you know, that disease and bad governments didn't take me away.
Sometimes they conspire.
Yeah. That I was allowed to pursue my trade, you know, and you know, and stuff like this is fun. I love doing this. And none of your listeners has enough money to buy my box set. I know that going in.
But if
going
they did,
in, yeah.
They should pick up the incredible Mel Brooks and Irresistible Collection of Unhinged Comedy, which I assume you can get at digital and in real life retailers as well.
Yeah, most of these things are so where are they sold?
This would probably be at, you know, like at your Walmarts and your Targets and
Amazon. Probably.
Amazon. Yeah. You can go to your Amazon, get yourself an Amazon locker, and you can have stuff.
Oh, well, what was that thing? Oh God! I wish I had it, Shelby.
Yeah.
What was that Amazon thing? That was our price. Our price. Amazon said our price.
I think they're at like 86 right now.
They said no. This is it. I gotta get home. They
retail
said
price.
89. Yeah. They said okay. 89.97, and then they said 89 something. Our price. You save, it says, 7 cents. And they printed it.
First of all, from what?
The paper, yeah. The paper alone. You save 7 cents. But here's the way it works. You make these things, and there's a big price, $89. In 2 months, no matter where, what, it's $69. You can get it for $69. In 6 months, it's got to be closer to $49, right? In 2 years, it's $1.28, you know? You can get it somewhere, you know, Chinatown or somewhere, you know?
Where you are, where you'll be taking the movies.
Oh, yeah, you're selling your
all your Academy screeners.
Yeah. I sell them.
Well, we usually end the podcast by telling people to enjoy their burrito, which means to, you know, like enjoy your present, enjoy your life. Would you give us that honor of telling people to enjoy their burrito?
Sure, what do you want me to say?
Just say enjoy your burrito.
Hiya, folks. This is Mel Brooks telling you to enjoy your burrito, whatever that means.
Well, that's my fucking ringtone forever.
Yeah.
Enjoy your burrito is essentially is.
Uh-oh.
It is.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Is.
Enjoy is. Enjoy your burrito, which is. Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Oh, thanks,
like
Mel.
Yeah.
Good to see
you,
man.
Thanks for coming up here.
Thank you for having us.
That all down.
Pleasure.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.